got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. Plant diseases destroy about 15% of the crops that we grow every year all around the world. And this represents roughly $220 billion worth of losses to farmers. Now, sometimes these losses can be prevented with pesticides, but unfortunately, chemicals don't always work. And this is obviously a bad thing for you and me, since we all need to eat food. So today I'm talking with Diana Horvath, who is a biologist working to solve this massive problem posed by plant disease. Diana heads up a research nonprofit called the Two Blades Foundation, which is working to save the world's most important crops with the latest innovations in plant science. So I want to find out a little bit more about Diana as a scientist and how she came to do the work that she's doing. And of course, I want to learn a little bit more about Two Blades itself. Now, before we get to the interview, just a quick programming note. You might notice a little bit of echo on my voice this week, and that's because we are renovating the studio, and so I'm doing this podcast from home. Now, the interview is still good quality. You can hear the conversation. I think you'll get a lot out of it, but just a heads up. So with that out of the way, here we go. All right, Diana, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. How are you, Cameron?
Oh, just so excited. It's Friday. So before we get into the work that Two Blades does, I want to find out more about you. I mean, do you have some experience that turned you on to science and then to genetics more specifically? Did you read a book or did you have an experience as a kid or anything like that?
Well, I think I've had my interest in plants and science as far back as I can remember. I grew up in New York State where there was an area of farming around. So that was there. And my mother was a big gardener. And although at the time when I was a kid, it was more of a pain to work in the garden. I had to do weeding and things I didn't really like at the time. It really stuck with me that I enjoyed watching and helping plants to grow. And that my father, who's a doctor, always interested me in science. And we would collect tadpoles, for example, and look at them under the microscope. And so from early years, I've always had that combination of interests.
So your career track makes sense then, being the foundation that you had. So tell us a little bit about Two Blades. I mean, what do you guys do? Who are you? And why is it so important that that the work that you guys do advances?
Well, we're a sort of strange hybrid kind of organization. I recently started reading Stephen Johnson's book entitled Where Good Ideas Come From, where he describes a term, the adjacent possible, which is about a space of known building blocks of various kinds that recombine in various ways to create new stuff, like molecules or computers or the internet. And Two Blades is kind of like that, in that we took building blocks in plant science and funding and technology licensing, product development, commercial agriculture, smallholder crops, and we put them together in a different way in order to solve difficult problems. And we have a single mission, which is to advance durable resistance to crop disease. So it's probably important to explain why crop disease is important. And I find that in wealthy countries like the U.S., I can chat with people in day-to-day life and ask them if they can name a crop disease. And most often they can't, not a single one. Or maybe they say, isn't there some blight of something? But most of the time, I like to refer to crop disease as the biggest threat to food security that most people have never heard of. And disease-causing microbes of plants have major impacts on food production, both pre- and post-harvest. And this has gotten a bit more attention in the news in recent times about food waste and food loss. But mostly people think about that as food waste, the edible food that gets thrown away. But in many parts of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, the greatest causes of food loss are in production and storage. So overall, globally, crop diseases cause losses of about 15% of all food produced every year. And that has an economic cost of about $220 billion a year. And some individual diseases can cause damage on the order of $10 billion in losses alone. For example, late blight of potato. And late blight is a fungus, well, not a fungus, it's something called an oomycete called Phytophthora infestans. And that name means plant destroyer. And it's a very apt name. It's the same pathogen that caused the Irish potato famine back in the 1800s. And I don't know if many people realize that it's still destroying potato crops around the world today.
So we're talking about real serious issues then, right? I mean, I think did you just say 15% of all damage in the developing world?
Well, 15% of all food produced globally every year is lost to plant diseases.
Okay. All right. So this is no small matter. I think especially here in the U.S., we can lose sight of that because I can drive down the street to 7 grocery stores right now and buy whatever I want. But that doesn't mean that's always going to be the case or that that's happening around the world. So I want to find out more about what you guys are doing. So you're trying to actually breed resistance into various staple crops that people rely on. Is that a fair assessment of what you guys are doing?
Yeah, well, so by a little bit more way of background, I should say that crop diseases, as you're saying, we don't see the impact so much here because our grocery stores always have food in them, basically. And so if we don't have good production of one crop, it's probably replaced on the shelf by a different product. So you don't really see it. And also because in countries like the U.S., we have a pretty robust system for managing diseases in the field to minimize the introduction and spread. And we can use crop protection chemicals, and plant breeding has been pretty effective at dealing with a lot of diseases. So our food production is pretty stable, but that's not true everywhere. And even here, we still growers have to scan every year for crop diseases and try to manage those. But in addition to those tools, since about the 1980s, research in cell and molecular biology and the advancements of tools for genomics and DNA sequence have developed a lot more tools and the capability to have a real fundamental molecular understanding of plant disease and plant immunity. And a particularly rich source for this knowledge has come from a laboratory in the UK, the Sainsbury Laboratory, which is really the leading one for plant pathogen research in the world. And that's been operating since 1987. And remarkably, there have been great achievements from their work and others, especially with the really steady, continued support for that basic research. But what Two Blades was set up to address was the fact that strikingly very little of that understanding of plant disease and immunity had reached through to the business of crop production. So we set up in 2004, sort of a long answer to your question, really to bridge that gap between the successful research in the laboratory and the practical applications in the field for agriculture. So we run programs that try to address this, particularly focusing on major diseases of major crops and trying specifically to create long-lasting resistance for diseases that are not really managed by conventional breeding and chemicals.
So tell us a little bit about the kinds of genetic tools you guys are using. I'm sure most people listening are familiar with the evil three-letter word GMO, and then they've heard about CRISPR, and maybe they've heard about mutagenesis. But what kind of techniques are you guys using in the lab to try to give these crops resistance to these really serious diseases?
We make use of genetic resources exclusively. So we're not involved in the discovery of new chemicals, for example, but using what we know from the basic molecular knowledge of the plant itself and the disease-causing pathogens that infect them, we can understand what are the mechanisms by which disease happens and also immunity, and how can we use these as strategies to thwart the disease from taking hold. And so we may use some of that knowledge in DNA markers that can be used for breeding when there's a resistance gene that's known, and that can occur through conventional breeding. But really, by and large, we find that the best way to deal with a crop disease is to make really multiple hurdles for that pathogen. So combining different resistance genes and different mechanisms of resistance to create sort of a solid barrier that makes it hard for the pathogen to overcome those. And this is important because a plant pathologist will tell you, never bet against the pathogen. And that's because pathogens evolve, and sometimes in a single growing season, and they can defeat disease resistance that are based on single genes. So it's really important to have multiple genes there. And so that's what we do. We make stacks and introduce those into crops. And in that way, it's something kind of similar to the treatment for HIV, where it moved to using a triple cocktail, so three drugs at once, and that makes it harder for HIV to overcome that treatment as well. It's a similar kind of concept.
So just because you mentioned HIV, are the pathogens you're talking about, are they really prone to mutate constantly, like more than, you know, what you might see in another field of research, and that's why it's so challenging to stay on top of them?
Well, different pathogens can have different rates of change. Viruses are notorious for really changing very frequently, but also some pathogens are very complex. They have maybe more than one genome in them. That's true of some of the rust pathogens, fungal pathogens that have multiple sets, so they can recombine and have sexual recombination in different ways, and that creates a lot of variety within the pathogen. So there can be different rates, and keeping up with it can be challenging. Another aspect is some crops themselves, the genetics are challenging, such as wheat. Wheat has three genomes in it, and so that makes breeding quite challenging.
Now, I saw a couple of terms on your website, and I want you to introduce these to people because, and they're kind of technical, but this is a science podcast, so let's try to learn a little bit of science. So the two terms I heard or read a lot was effector and then NLR protein. Can you explain what those are and how they relate to the work you guys are doing to build the resistance you're talking about?
Definitely. So an effector is a protein produced by a pathogen. And just to be really clear about everything, a pathogen is a microbe that causes disease. So not all microbes cause disease, but we're just concerned with those that do. And it should be said, as an aside, that plants are resistant to most pathogens, or I should say most microbes, that we're all, as you're probably aware, covered in microbes of different kinds. And for plants, that's true. And of course, plants can't move around or take some steps to avoid disease like people or animals can. They're stuck in one place. But it's really just a few that can overcome the basic defenses that plants have and cause disease. And generally, plants do have really strong immune systems to fight off disease. And in fact, this approach that we take of bringing in disease resistance genes really comes from the notion of sharing knowledge, in a sense, in that we're going to a crop, to its relatives, and we're looking for resistances that they have. And what this allows is that the plants into which the genes are introduced are making use of their own immunity, but they've just now been given the ability to recognize a particular pathogen that they couldn't recognize before. And then their innate immunity is doing the rest.
So in most cases, then there's just other, say wheat, for example, there's other types of wheat that might have the resistance that you want to put into the commercialized variety. Is that right?
Or if not wheat, another cereal grass plant might have it. And so it's just a matter of extending that repertoire. And individual plants may have hundreds of resistance genes. And that's what you were asking about effectors and NLRs. An NLR, that's just an abbreviation for a type of resistance gene, the most common one. It stands for nucleotide binding leucine-rich repeat protein, and that just describes its physical structure. And those NLR proteins are widespread in all plants. So you might be adding one or two to a plant that already has a repertoire of 500 of those. So that's on the one side, that's the plant side. The effector is something on the pathogen side. It's a protein that the pathogen introduces into the plant cell to subvert that immune system. So basically, it gives the pathogen the ability to establish disease.
Okay. And so you guys are more or less trying to immunize the plant against that. Is that right?
Right. The more we know about the pathogen and which effectors it's using and how those effectors work, it's like if you had your home was under attack by a burglar and you understood how the burglar was trying to get in through the window or by jimmying the lock. If you knew those different ways, you could block them appropriately.
Very, very interesting. Okay, so let's get into some specifics. I mean, we've mentioned wheat sort of, so let's start there. So tell us a little bit about wheat stem rust and why it's such a problem for growers around the world, and then we'll go from there.
Wheat is one of the most important food crops in the world. 20% of the world's calories comes from wheat. So the crop itself is very important, and it suffers from several serious diseases. An emerging one is wheat blast, which arrived for the first time in Bangladesh in 2016. And that's very frightening because there's a lot of wheat production in Bangladesh and India. And so farmers there are so concerned, they're burning their fields to try to limit the spread of wheat blast. Another long-term foe of wheat is stem rust. And that's a fungus that's been recorded as causing epidemics since back in Roman times. It can completely destroy a crop in just a few weeks and over wide areas. And that's because a single pustule of a fungal infection on a single leaf contains thousands of spores that can be carried on the wind over wide distances. There are terrifying photos showing tractors operating in infected fields with clouds of reddish spores kicking up around them. And that's just such a huge pool of inoculum. And that's how it can really spread over a great area and cause a serious impact. Globally, stem rust has caused famines and ruined economies. In the U.S., there have been three major outbreaks. And it's so deadly that during World War II, several countries prepared stockpiles of the spores for potential use as biological weapons. But the stem rust problem was solved. It was solved by an Iowa agronomist named Norman Borlaug during the 1950s. And Borlaug was successful in breeding stem rust resistant wheat lines, and he helped distribute those around the world. And as a result, stem rust basically was a problem that was solved for 40 years. But then starting in the late 1990s, a new strain of rust first appeared in Africa that broke down the resistance in those wheat lines that Borlaug had bred. And since then, the number of new strains and the areas where they occur have just been steadily growing.
What kind of progress have you guys made in addressing that?
Yeah, so conventional breeding has, of course, been tackling this problem, and there's been some wonderful progress there despite the complexity of wheat. And we want to think about producing next generation solutions to that to keep up with the pace of the pathogen evolution. And we would love to see stem rust taken off the table altogether as a breeding target and allow breeding to focus on other traits like quality and yield. But we've been undertaking a program since 2008, which has been pretty successful to date. We have an international consortium of scientists that we work with and others, and we have collaborators at the Australian Scientific Research Organization called CSIRO. Nick Aliff and Peter Dodds there have successfully put together a set of five resistance genes that they introduced into wheat lines. And we've now done two field tests of those that have been run by a stem rust specialist, Brian Stephenson, at the University of Minnesota. And their team has shown that these lines perform so well in the field under heavy inoculation with stem rust, or really kick the tires, that he had to come up with a new disease rating for the results. Normally, the rating scales go down to one for the lowest level of disease, and he rated these a zero. So we're very excited to see that this stack that we're testing out now is proving to be successful in really controlling stem rust.
Well, that's very exciting. How soon do you anticipate a technology like this actually coming to market where it can benefit farmers around the world?
Well, there are challenges to that in some crops like wheat, which is a global commodity, and where you're talking about introducing multiple genes, and there's commercial supply chains. That's a tricky issue because there are regulatory aspects and consumer concerns to think about. So we're not sure how quickly we can expect to have a wheat line on the market. And this project is one we almost really think of as protection against real downside events happening in the world to wheat. But we do have other programs that we're working on that have a shorter path to market, and some enabling technologies that we've worked on that have already been put to use and are out there helping people today, whether they're markers for breeding, for example, in peppers. We've been doing some licensing of a marker there, and we've also licensed an enabling technology for gene editing that's been out there for a number of years. So those products can get to market relatively quickly, and some of the others take longer.
So you've mentioned marker-assisted breeding a couple times. Can you just explain how that works? Because I think a lot of people probably aren't too familiar with it.
Marker-assisted breeding takes advantage of knowing a lot about the DNA for a particular plant. And there's an association, or maybe an exact knowledge, of which sequences in the genome give rise to a particular trait. So if it's a disease resistance gene, it may mean that you know the exact gene, or you know a DNA sequence that's very close to it. And having that information means that when you're doing conventional breeding, that is, you're making a cross between two plants, and then you're scanning all the progeny from that cross to find the ones that have that resistance trait, for example, you can, instead of waiting to grow them up and seeing how they respond to disease pressure, you can select them early on using this DNA marker. So you take a sample of their tissue and you get the DNA, and then you look for the presence of the marker. And then you know that plant most likely has the disease trait. If it's in a gene, then you for sure know that it has that gene. So then you can just select those, and that accelerates the breeding and makes it much more efficient. But it's just using conventional breeding and then that selection using the marker.
Very, very cool. So previously people were more or less guessing at like which plants to cross. And now you guys are sort of honing in on exactly which ones are going to give you the trait that you want, which is super cool. But tell us a little bit about how you're using the gene editing technology. Are you guys using CRISPR, or what method are you guys using, and how does it work exactly?
Yes, well, we're not doing a ton of editing in our current programs. In some ways, that's because for this kind of trait that we're solving, there are not so many approaches, so many targets that you would have for a gene editing approach. But I think there's some confusion about how we talk about gene editing that's worth touching on. I think in most cases, people think of gene editing as the process of going into an organism and making very small changes. And it usually means taking away an activity. And there's a second meaning in which you can use gene editing, which really is a a system of targeting very specific DNA sequences. And you can also use that recognition capability to insert a gene exactly where you want it. But generally, the concept of inserting DNA into an organism really is more the realm of transgenics or GMOs. So for the most part, when people think about gene editing, they're talking about that first type of effort that you can make to make small changes. And so for disease, as I've explained, we see the strongest way of creating durable resistance is adding these multiple genes. Then to be able to put them into a targeted location is very desirable. So the concept of using gene editing to do that, to insert genes in a specific place, is very useful. Now, there are some what are known as susceptibility loci, that is, places within the genome in which a sequence makes that plant more susceptible. So it's something that the pathogen might take advantage of to cause disease. Those are places where you can use gene editing essentially to interfere, scramble those sequences so that the pathogen can't take advantage of them. And there are some, but there's relatively a small number of those. So it's not a large effort that we've put in. But we have been involved in promoting and licensing and trying to make an industry platform of one particular gene editing tool known as TALENs. So we had a large activity in supporting and licensing that broadly.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you explained that, because I think, as you said, people have the impression that there's just genetic engineering and it's all the same amalgamation of things to manipulate plants. And that's not the case. There's actually different tools for very specific purposes. So thank you for explaining that. I want to move on to another example from your website, and that's the issue of citrus canker. So as you did with wheat rust, can you explain what citrus canker is and why it's such a big deal and then how you guys are trying to combat it?
Yes, citrus canker, actually, and together with a second bacterial disease of citrus called citrus greening, have really devastated citrus production, especially in the U.S. And together with some of the tropical storms that have taken place in recent years, the citrus industry in the U.S. is really in poor shape. The production is at its lowest level in, I think it's 75 years now, and millions of dollars are lost every year. A large number of jobs have been lost as a result. A lot of the production is now coming from Brazil. The price of orange juice has doubled, I believe, since 2005. So the industry has been very hard hit with citrus canker and citrus greening. And citrus, we've worked on programs with both. Citrus canker is a little bit more of a straightforward pathogen. We have been testing a couple of approaches there by actually gene editing in one case. It is one of the cases where we've used gene editing and adding a gene in another case. And we do have some citrus material, some trees that are under testing now to see how they're going to perform against citrus canker. For citrus greening, that is a really tough disease because the way it's introduced puts it into a part of the cell that's really hard to access. And so normal disease resistance strategies are challenging. And that's partly because citrus greening is introduced by an insect and it's inserted into the plant cell kind of past the normal defenses. So that's one where really we have been unsuccessful, and we really hope that others are able to succeed on that one because it is such a major disease issue for the industry. But we may yet be able to make a contribution against citrus canker.
Yeah, and talk a little bit more about that, because it's not just a matter of these diseases being there. It's the fact that there aren't that many tools that growers have to address the issues. And I think with citrus canker, they can rely on copper fungicides for the most part, right? And why is that a problem to have just that one chemical approach, would you say?
Yes, well, there's a number of issues with using the copper fungicides. It's also one that's widely used in other aspects of crop production against bacteria. But bacteria can develop resistance to copper products. This is certainly the case in tomato, which is another area that we've worked on quite a bit. And so spraying a lot of copper becomes ineffective on pathogens if they develop resistance. And also leads to accumulation of copper on the fruits, either citrus or tomato fruits, or directly in the sandy soils in Florida. And so copper tends to get concentrated. If you take tomato fruits or citrus fruits and you take them to pack houses and you're washing them, then that wastewater is known to concentrate copper to a level that then becomes a real disposal issue. So it would be great to have alternatives to the copper fungicides.
So, and I've heard different experts offer different opinions on this, but would it be, it would just be like widening the toolbox. So you wouldn't completely phase out chemical fungicides, but you would have these genetic resistance tools, and then you would also have the crop protection tools. And between all of them, that would sort of mount a viable defense for these crops. Is that a fair assessment?
I would certainly say that we need all the tools in the tool chest in agriculture, including chemical crop protection methods, including management tools, including gene editing, including transgenics. All of these have a role to play to ensure that we can produce the food that we need to, not only today, but as we add more than 2 billion people by 2050, and we have to continue to increase crop production in order to feed everybody. So we're really going to need all the tools. And we do hope that some of the genetic tools provide the most effective and environmentally benign way to protect harvests while reducing chemical use and the environmental impact. So that's why we really emphasize taking genetic approaches, because they do have that potential, not only just to control diseases in the here and now, but to contribute to what we'll need to do is sustainable intensification of agriculture to meet that growing food demand, but to do more with less. And so less chemicals, less land, less water, and overall less food loss. And if we're able to do that, we'll be able to contribute to several of the global sustainability development goals that should contribute to ending hunger, achieving food security, reducing food loss, improving nutrition and health, and so on. Basically, attaining a more sustainable agriculture with that lower environmental footprint.
Well, it sounds like you've got your work cut out for you. Where can people go to find out more about Two Blades and the work that you guys are doing?
Well, we have our website, which has a lot of this information on it, which is at twoblades.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook, and subscribe to our newsletter to hear more about what we're doing. And we really hope people do come to understand that crop disease is a force that needs to be recognized, and that we actually, though it's serious, it's great because we actually have tools to do something about it. So we welcome people learning more about that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, as you guys make progress, I'd love to have you back on to talk more about this.
Thank you so much, Cameron.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us. We will see you next time. As always, I want to remind you to check us out on iTunes and Spotify, and check out the podcast at geneticliteracyproject.org.